Thank you, Dr. Matthews. Thank you, musicians. Thank you again, President Valentine, for your good word today. It is so appropriate on this beginning of the fall semester. Some of you may have heard that I spoke at commencement this summer in July and finished in 10 minutes. I spoke at the White Coat Ceremony this past Wednesday, 12 minutes. I have some time in the bank, so just sit back and relax. I promise to be finished before noon. I heard a story recently about four people who arrived at the gates of heaven simultaneously. One was a Baptist, one was a Lutheran, one was a Methodist, one was a Presbyterian. The angel came to the gates, greeted them all, and said, "I think I'll just take you in alphabetical order," and invited the Baptist in first. So they went through the heavenly gates and walked down the golden streets, and someone like Professor Mann was there leading the musicians, and the band began to play, and a parade went down the street to welcome the Baptist who had arrived. They went into a banquet room and enjoyed a great banquet. The choir was there to sing. The harps were there to play. And then the angel ushered the Baptist to his new heavenly room. He went back to the gates, and there waiting patiently was the Lutheran, the Methodist, and the Presbyterian. And he said, "Why don't the three of you just come with me together?" And he went and he took them to their rooms. They were a bit miffed, and they said, "Why didn't we get the band and the choir and the banquet as well?" And he said, "We see Lutherans and Methodists and Presbyterians here every day, but it's been a long time since one of those Baptists got here. So I want to tell you a story today about some of the Baptists who got there, some of the great cloud of witnesses who made it and have been a part of Union University. There have been some significant shaping moments throughout our history, and if you understand this framework, then you can hang a lot of the other aspects of our history on these big picture items. First of all, to understand that this city in which we are located, this town at the time, Jackson, was founded in 1822, and the city leader said shortly thereafter, "We need a school, an institution," and an academy was formed in 1823. And if you trace the legal history of Union University back, you can find it begins there at 1823, founded in 1823, chartered in 1825. That academy soon became a college, West Tennessee College, in the 1840s. And that was in Jackson, Tennessee, and simultaneously in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the middle of the state, was a school founded named Union University. Union University was brought together by Baptists in the West, Baptists in the East, and some Baptists in North Alabama. Now, there was no Tennessee Baptist Convention at the time, and this school was what was used to hold these various and diverse Baptist groups together. And they existed, this West Tennessee College, which was greatly influenced by the First Baptist Church of Jackson, and Union University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, side by side for almost 30 years. But shortly after the Civil War, the Tennessee Baptist Convention was formed after several failed attempts throughout the 19th century. But it was formed and formalized in 1874 and 1875, and the second act of business of the Tennessee Baptist Convention was to bring together these two schools and form them into one, and to move Union University to Jackson, Tennessee. But instead of naming it Union or naming it West Tennessee College, they gave the school a new name, Southwest Baptist University, which pleased no one, and it allowed them to begin the school afresh and anew. It began as Southwest Baptist University with this big, grandiose vision for reaching the Southwest, and they named trustees not only from Tennessee, but from Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Arkansas. The school had a big vision, but it never quite materialized at that time. For you see, by the 1970s, when the school came to this campus, there were 800 students, about 720 of whom were from West Tennessee. And the idea of reaching far beyond this region really did not happen until several decades later. There was a dream to rename the school Union University. Now remember, that name went away in the 1870s, just a few years after the Civil War. And so the alumni of Union University in Murfreesboro appealed on an annual basis to change the name of the school, but there was not much of a reception to naming anything Union in West Tennessee just a few years after the Civil War. And so it took an entire generation to move off the scene before the name could be changed. And it was in 1907, and that has been our name. And so we have this wonderful kind of piece-together puzzle that forms our heritage that has been one steady stream since 1907. But all of those things kind of were part of weaving into this quilt that made us who we are, this cloud of witnesses that has shaped us along the way. There were some people who were quite foundational to our work. R.B.C. Howell, perhaps the greatest Tennessee Baptist of the 19th century, pastor of the First Baptist Church of Nashville, Tennessee, was the chairman of the board of Union University. And it was his dream to have higher education, Christian higher education, Baptist higher education in the state of Tennessee. As a matter of fact, he wanted very badly to establish the first seminary in Nashville, but Southern Seminary instead was founded in South Carolina before moving to Louisville, Kentucky. But Dr. Howell was a key leader across the state, and his shadow loomed large over Union University in the middle part of the 19th century. You can see there the other pictures in the slide. T.P. Crawford was one of the first missionaries sent out from Union University, and he eventually became the supervisor of Lottie Moon for several years in China. And then the first two presidents of Union University during that time, Joseph Eaton and then Charles Manley, from the famous Manley family that influenced Southern Baptists so much throughout the 19th century. We come from great stock. This cloud of witnesses that surround us is one for which we should give thanks. We have the privilege each and every day to stand on their shoulders. We drink from wells we did not dig. We eat from gardens we did not plant. And we have the wonderful privilege, as Caleb has said, to pass on the heritage that is ours, both a great privilege and a wonderful responsibility. But in the 1870s, after the founding of the school anew, in Jackson, Tennessee, it moved in a little different direction. Now, the person who helped move it in that direction was J.R. Graves, who would probably roll over in his grave today if I talked about a new direction, for he made his name famous by a sermon and a booklet that went all over the South called The Old Landmarks. He did not want anything to do with anything new or new directions. But he actually brought a new dimension and a new direction to Union and understanding of our Baptist heritage and the Baptist church that still looms around us some. But J.R. Graves served as the chairman of the board for Union University for almost two decades. And just as a footnote, his daughter was one of the first students, first women students ever at Union. J.M. Pendleton was one of the best faculty members during that time. And the first president in Jackson was a man named George Jarman, who served for almost 14 years and gave stability in trying to bring the two institutions together. Jarman's faithful leadership was carried forward by the grand old man of Union University, George M. Savage. And to my left, walking, if you walk straight out the chapel, go out that door, there's a big cedar tree out there, and underneath that cedar tree is a plaque that is dedicated to the grand old man, George M. Savage, who spent his life here for decade after decade. You'll notice that he did 18 years as president, but that's the way to do it. Do 13, take a break, do a couple, take a break, and then do a few more instead of plowing through for 18 straight years. There's something to learn here from the wisdom of Dr. Savage. He was a scholar, leader, statesman, preacher, greatly appreciated in West Tennessee and admired in the Southern Baptist world, and was able to connect Union at that time with the development of the Southern Baptist Convention, as indicated by the quality of visiting faculty he brought here in the 1890s. A who's who of Southern Baptist life. J.M. Frost was the first president and founder of the Baptist Sunday School Board. B.H. Carroll, at that time, the 1890s, was chairman of the religion department at Baylor University and went on to be the founder and president of Southwestern Baptist Seminary in 1908, and the greatest biblical scholar in Southern Baptist history, A.T. Robertson, all taught at Union University during this time. It indicates the strong relationship that Union has always had with the Baptist world. But you understand that this history that is ours, this heritage that is ours, has also been shaped by disappointment. We've known great high water marks, but there have been setbacks and challenges along the way. And perhaps few as devastating as the fire of 1912, which destroyed College Hall and the Powell Chapel and took years to overcome. Two presidents served 4 years together during this time because they were so exhausted from trying to rebuild the campus after this time. But then Dr. Savage came, was able to bring some stability, and shortly thereafter, he was followed by Henry Waters. Henry Waters served for 13 years at Union, and we have a wonderful residence life hall area called Waters that is named for this president. Together with John Jeter Hurt, they were bookends that took us from World War I to World War II with the Depression in between. These were very difficult years, and they were wonderful statesmen and leaders. John Jeter Hurt was a terrific leader in Baptist life. He came to the presidency of Union University from the pastorate of First Baptist Church of Jackson. Now, at the time, First Baptist Church of Jackson was the church in West Tennessee, the only tall steeple church in all of West Tennessee, and the first church to ever build a building that cost $100,000. And John Jeter Hurt was pastor of this congregation, and they called him from that congregation to serve Union University, which at the time was a small school of about 300 students. And people said, why would he leave that thriving congregation to go and serve as president at Union? Now, some of you have heard me tell this story before, but it's one of the favorite lines in our history. He said, the deacons at First Baptist Church meet every month, and the trustees at Union University only meet twice a year. Therefore, it is much wiser for me to move in that direction. Following World War II, after the leadership of Hurt and Waters, Union really came of age academically, and that was led by Warren Jones. Warren Jones was really the first academic leader Union had ever known. He was the first manager of the campus. He was the first one to bring business savvy to what went on around us. And Warren Jones' legacy was very significant. He served for almost 18 years and brought the greatest building boom that Union had ever known up until that time. During his years as president, the student union building, the science building, the gymnasium, and two residence life halls were built. Union achieved accreditation for the very first time under Dr. Jones, and the academic stature and the quality of faculty improved greatly. Today, Warren Jones Academic Suite, which houses the honors program, is appropriately named for this one who had such a significant hand in raising the academic bar at Union University. Dr. Jones served up until the early years of the 1960s. 1963, his last year as president, was a traumatic year in this country. 50 years ago, President Kennedy was assassinated. We'll talk about that, I'm sure, a lot as we move into the fall of November 22, 1963, also the day that C.S. Lewis passed away. This week, you'll probably hear a great deal about Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech and the March on Washington, which took place 50 years ago this week. But perhaps a little closer to home, we sometimes forget that in 1963, Martin Luther King spent time in the Birmingham jail, from which he wrote his famous letter from the Birmingham jail, the time when Medgar Evers was assassinated in Mississippi. And on September 15th, 1963, I was a 10-year-old boy that went to Hunter Street Baptist Church one Sunday morning. I came home. Four little girls went to 16th Street Baptist Church, September 15th, 1963. A bomb blast kept them from ever coming home again. We need to reflect upon what has happened at Union University and across the South over the past 50 years and give thanks for that, even as we recommit ourselves in the future toward our efforts of racial reconciliation. 1963 was the year in my home state, one of the dark days in our history, in which the governor, George Wallace, stood in the doors at the University of Alabama and declared, "Segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever." During that time, the leaders at Union University were wise enough to open their doors. Lonnie Searcy became the first African-American student at Union University. His solo entrance is now multiplied hundreds and thousands of times. For this year, we'll have almost 1,200 minority students out of 5,000 who will enroll at Union University. And we give thanks for the progress that has been made, but we also recognize how far we still have to go to be agents of reconciliation at Union University. But during the 60s and 70s, Union began to change a great deal. New opportunities came. Campus was moved from the old downtown campus where it had been from 1823 to 1975. Union had a need to reconnect with the churches and to strengthen its ties to the community, and that was done with two bookend presidents, Robert Craig and Hiram Barefoot, who served together at this place for well over a quarter of a century. They provided stable oversight to restore the church relationships and the work with the Tennessee Baptist Convention. They led us to this place, this new campus, which was opened in the fall of 1975. We still sit in the chapel that is there on the far right-hand side of that screen. But in 1975, that was the campus at Union University, one building that was dropped down into 100 acres of mud. And out here in nowhere land, in what was nowhere, none one had ever heard of North Jackson at the time. It was just out here, all by itself, lonely building, sitting here 200 yards, two football fields long, 200,000 square feet, under one roof, mall-like, as functional as one could imagine, but not necessarily aesthetically pleasing. But we still benefit from this building. And we give thanks for it. And it's a part of our fascinating story. And if you understand Union's heritage from 1823 that has gone through these various rivers and tributaries and how it has all come together, we recognize that Union basically is a story of faith. Moreover, it's a story of faith in God's faithfulness. It's a recognition that we move forward with confidence because of the hope that God has given to us. Not a wish, but a genuine hope grounded in the promises of God and his great faithfulness to us, evidenced by signs of his divine providence that can be seen over and over and over again throughout our history. It's a fascinating story summarized by faith in God's faithfulness, hope in divine providence. In that sense, we're not unlike the people of God throughout history. We join with this large stream of God's people identified in the passage that Dr. Sanderson read for us earlier in Hebrews chapter 11. It's in many ways beginning with the call of Abraham and Sarah out of Ur. For in that great passage in Hebrews chapter 11, we are told that without faith it is impossible to please God. We're a part of a larger stream of God's people, Old Testament prophets, New Testament apostles, early church bishops, medieval theologians and educators, reformers and revivalists, a people of faith on pilgrimage, and we join in that stream. What's interesting about Hebrews 11, however, is that we call it the Hall of Fame or this Heroes of Faith. But if you look closely at those who are there, they're really just fumbling, faltering, flawed men and women, just like you and just like me. People who place their trust and hope in a faithful God, and God has somehow worked through them, to use them to accomplish his purposes. But with each and every one of them, there's always some sense of incompleteness in the story. They sought to follow and obey God, but they didn't always have the answers. They didn't always understand even what they were told. Following that verse where it says, without faith, it is impossible to please God in verse 6, we learn about Noah in verse 7, who was told about a coming flood and a judgment. But up until that time, there had been no flood or judgment. He hardly knew what God was talking to him about. In verse 8, we are told that Abraham and Sarah were called out of Ur into a land they did not know. And they went, they obeyed, not knowing where they were going. There was an incompleteness. There was no understanding, really, of what they were to do. For you see, God called Abraham and told him what to do, but there was no example for him to follow. When we talk today about living by faith, we point to Abraham. And we have biographies on our shelves of Hudson Taylor and Lottie Moon and William Carey and people who have lived by faith, who have gone before us. Abraham and Sarah had no biographies, no model, no example, no scripture as far as I know. And there they obeyed. A commentator has said Hebrews 11, story of Abraham, is characterized by three unanswered questions. The where question, the when question, and the how question. There was no answer, really. Abraham is commended because when God called him to a place he did not know, he went out not knowing where he was going. The Jewish historian Philo said of Abraham that when God spoke, you would have thought that God said, leave a foreign place and go home. Because Abraham left home to go to a foreign place so quickly. Abraham and Sarah obeyed, not knowing where they were going. Now, Abraham was a prominent businessman in Mesopotamia. And I'm sure had he been invited to go to the Mesopotamian Institute on business studies and said, how do you present a strategic plan? And he would have said, here are the three things you always have to answer in a strategic plan. Know where you're going, how long it's going to take you to get there, and know how you're going to get there, then he would have said, here's the 3 points, where I don't know, when I don't know, and how I don't know. But God has called me to do this. And Abraham and Sarah did so, all in God's timing. The where question, I'm sure, in 1874, to those Baptists in Middle Tennessee, when they heard that Union University was going to come to Jackson and join West Tennessee College, they said, where? And in 1975, when those in the downtown campus said we're going to move the campus out north, out there on the other side, there was no I-40, there was no bypass, there was nothing out here. We're just going out there in nowhere land. And they said, where? But that's part of our history. People have been courageous, living by faith, even when they did not know the answer to the where question. It's been also true of the when question. Abraham and Sarah did not know when they were going to inherit this land that God had promised them. It was all in God's timing. And when he spoke to them, they were already 75 years of age, not exactly young pups, and they had to see what God was going to do with them. I'm sure on the 100th birthday of Abraham, he said, Lord, I have a wish today. When is this going to happen? I'm sure on his 137th birthday, he was journaling and he said, you know, we buried Sarah today. When are we going to have the land? Abraham lived to be 174, never quite fully inherited what God had promised him. Sometimes God's timing takes strange turns. It takes longer than we planned. We initiated a study for a mission statement early on in this administration. It stayed in the oven for a number of years, only to be outlasted by the core curriculum study, which we thought would never come out. But once it did, God used it for good among us. We were able to build Hammonds Hall and Jennings Hall and Miller Tower, and then we thought we could build White Hall. And we waited, and we waited, and what was supposed to be a 2-year project became a 5-year project. And often we have to wait for God's way of doing things. I'm sure that Abraham said, I don't know if I can continue to do this. People said, you're presumptuous to believe that God is going to do it. You're a crackpot, Abraham. You don't have answers to these things. The Bible said of Abraham, however, he's no presumptuous person. He was a friend of God. And the hardest question of all is how. Not only when and where, but how. Because God promised him not only a blessing and a land, but also a seed. And the text that Dr. Sanderson read for us said that Sarah was already beyond age and Abraham was good as dead. This was a biological impossibility. But when Abraham and Sarah heard what God had said, they laughed. Then the child was born. He was named Isaac, which means he laughed. God got the last laugh. We don't always know the answers to the questions where, when, and how. How will Union navigate the challenges ahead? When will God come and act? How will we make our way through these cultural and societal issues that are swirling around us? How will we navigate through the legal and governmental issues that lay in our path? What will we do with the seemingly rising challenges in the financial and economic arena? And what are we to do in the ecclesiastical and denominational world in this post-denominational day? If we learn anything from Hebrews chapter 11, we learn that we are people who are called to be sojourners, strangers in this world, called to struggle in faith. We are carried along by hope from faith to faith. For you see, faith in Hebrews chapter 11 has this future element to it. It functions almost like a synonym for hope, a confidence that the God who has faithfully acted in the past will again act in the future. At Union University, we talk about faith a lot. We talk about faith and learning as inherent, as central, as essential to carrying forth our mission. It is what we say makes us a distinctive institution. But when we talk about faith and learning, we're talking about faith in a different way than we're talking about it here this morning in Hebrews 11. For that is a faith that looks back to Jesus Christ, how he has come into this world, how he died, how he was raised from the dead, and that our faith is grounded in him. So that when we talk about faith and learning, it points to the past. It points to bringing that great Christian tradition into the present. And we seek to reclaim the Christian intellectual tradition as a part of our teaching, as a part of making that tradition come alive for a new generation of people. But not only do we need to understand the importance of faith and learning, but also faith and living. And here Hebrews chapter 11 brings our text together, for it points us to the future and gives us a sense of hope and hopefulness. It points us to an active, future-oriented faith that will carry us forward for the challenges ahead. Union needs both. It needs faith and faith. We need to move forward from faith to faith, recognizing there are unknown aspects of the future. There are challenges to come. But our confidence is not grounded in ourselves, but in a great and providential God, in the faithful God about whom we have sung even this morning. Even when we don't have the answers to the where, when, and how question, Hebrews chapter 11 points us forward. And it closes with a passage that really should be the last verse of chapter 11, but it's the first verse of chapter 12. This great cloud of witnesses that surrounds us, that enables us, that carries us forward. It is the title of Dr. Bagot's book when he wrote Our History, 1823 to 2000. I'm borrowing and building upon his theme today and learn much from him for the things that I have shared. Mindful around us of the great cloud of witnesses that shape who we are every day across this campus. They enable us to run the race that is set before us. And across this campus, if you look and you walk carefully and you observe what you see around you, you will find markers that point to this cloud of witnesses, to Hope Road, to Faith Road, to Providence Hall, to the Grace Complex, to the Hope Complex, to our Heritage Complex, that tell us about Drs. Hurt and Waters, that point us to Maggie Nell Brewer, who served for so long as the leader of our student life area, to Warren Jones and the academic suite, and in this place to the George M. Savage Memorial Chapel. When we see hurt and waters, we're reminded of those who have provided leadership in challenging times. When we see Maggie Nell Brewer, we are committed to students throughout our work at Union. When we see Warren Jones, we are called to raise the academic bar. When we see George M. Savage, we are reminded of the importance of faith, church, our Baptist heritage. It's a wonderful story that is ours. And the cloud of witnesses around us has multiple names. You could add dozens and hundreds of others to that. But there are three in particular that I think have been so important, that have really carried Union University forward over the last 40 years. For without them, the story may have been written very differently. They've known the challenges up close. They've seen disappointment. They've known dark days. They've understood the challenges like few others in the Union family. They've felt the sting at times of criticism. And in the midst of that, they have welcomed students. They have hosted trustees and donors. They have welcomed faculty and staff into their homes, all with grace and elegance and a smile on their face. Mrs. Craig, Mrs. Barefoot, and Lanise Dockery. All three wonderful in what they have done. One, I think, shines above them all. And without them, some of the discouraging days could have brought Union to a halt. But they have helped carry us through. And we, as we move forward as Christ followers into the 21st century, we're going to know discouraging and difficult and demanding days like never before. For even as we read about what's happening in the world around us, we heard just this week for the first time in 1,600 years, Coptic Christians did not have Mass on Sunday. Hundreds have been killed there and in Syria, in Iran, in North Korea, throughout Africa, the Middle East, into Southeast Asia. Our brothers and sisters in Christ, whom we may have slight doctrinal differences, have faced demanding and difficult days. At the end of Hebrews chapter 11, Dr. Sanderson reminded us of these words. Those who have gone before us have faced jeers and flogging and chains. They've been put in prison, stoned, sawed in two, put to death by the sword, destitute, persecuted, and mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. They were all commended for their faith because God had planned something better. We will face disappointments, challenges. Some of us will face martyrdom here in this room over the next 10, 25, 50 years as the world changes around us. Let's all be prepared for a different day, learning to live by faith with hope in a challenging context. For the first time in my lifetime, we have to come to grips with the reality that this could be our future. And therefore, we move forward as sojourners and strangers to face these difficulties and challenges. We will do so with faith in God's faithfulness and hope in divine providence. For God is the one who has orchestrated our past, and He is the one who will carry us forward into the future. These cloud of witnesses, they will enable us. They will help us move forward. We will move forward not only with a sense of faith in God's faithfulness, we will move forward believing the words that we have sung together this morning, recognizing that we don't do this alone. We move forward with and for all the saints. We move forward with the assurance of God's faithfulness. We move forward in joyful adoration. These songs speak to our hearts. They help us recognize that it is not a time for us to panic. While there are many unknowns, we should not be frightened. We should not be fearful. We move forward believing God's word and believing our great hymns. Today, we recognize that we are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses. We look to the future with hope and with faith, not because of anything in ourselves, but we move forward trusting in God. There are great days ahead for Union University. It has a bright and blessed future because it will live and live out of its glorious past. But more importantly than looking backward and living out of our past, we move forward looking for that city whose architect and builder is God. We come together this morning to look unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith. We do so recognizing that he will provide the enablement for our future. We trust him to continue to provide his favor and blessings on this place. We move forward today with a great sense that God's hand has rested on this institution for 190 years. And so today I invite you to join with me in moving forward in faith and in hope for the good of Union University and for the glory of our great God. It is a privilege to serve here in this place, side by side. We welcome new students. We are glad to have returning students here with us. You are privileged to study with one of the great teaching faculties to be found anywhere in the country, to be enabled by a staff committed to a distinctive mission. And so on this day, we celebrate God's blessings to this place, even as we ask for his blessings upon each one of you in the days ahead. May God's blessings rest upon Union University this day and in the future.